Breakfast, the History Show on 51551.
Welcome back. 51551 there is our text number. And Podge in Drumcondra texted, say the Irish saint, Saint Dimna, was murdered by her Irish father in Heel in Belgium following her elopement and by her mentally ill father. Following this, the locals looked after people with mental illness in the community. This presumably is going back to the 4th, 5th or 6th century or something like that. They never had an institution. In the early 1900s, Dr. Connolly Norman in St. Brendan's had patients living in the local community with sponsoring families. He was decades ahead of his time. That was until government policy changes in the 1980s. That's from Pod in Drumcondra. Now, this coming month, the National Gallery will host a series of lectures as well as full-day events on war poets and artists spanning several decades. With the centenary of World War I approaching, we're going to talk about three Irish war poets who might not be as familiar as names like Francis Ledwich and Tom Kettle. The first has connections with, as it happens, both World War I and the National Gallery. Thomas McGreevy fought in the war and went on to become the director of the National Gallery in 1950. Here's an example of his work.
I labour in a barren place, alone, self-conscious, frightened, blundering, far away, stars wheeling in space, about my feet, earth, voices, whispering.
I'm joined by Gerald Daw, Professor of English at Trinity College in Dublin, whose recent anthology of Irish war poetry takes its name from the last three words of that poem, Earth, Voices, Whispering. You're very welcome, Gerry. The poem that we heard was a very concise elegy written by McGreevy, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's called Nocturne. It's a kind of poem that more or less reveals his sense of the ghost lands of the battlefields. He didn't write a lot about war, but the poems that he wrote out of his experiences as a soldier in World War I, that experience kind of carries through for the rest of his writing life. In fact, you can almost say that McGreevy never really lost contact with that experience. But the little quatrain that you've just heard gives the title to the book, the anthology, Earth Voices Whispering. And I always remember when I was trying to work out how to configure this book, that line kept coming back to me, about my feet, earth voices whispering. The sense that these men had actually, who had suffered in the battlefields and the trenches of World War I, that their remains were physically embedded in this landscape, but also psychically embedded in the men that had survived.
And I think you read a biography of McGreevy, which you found quite fascinating.
He wrote different little bits of memoirs about his work, some of it about his life. He also started a novel. But this edition, maybe this is what you're referring to, The Life and Work of Thomas McGreevy, A Critical Reappraisal, was published last year by Susan Screveman, is really revisiting McGreevy's achievement, not just as a poet, but as a critic, a very important critic too, and as you said, as a director of the National Gallery. I mean, in a way, McGreevy's connection with Beckett has almost overshadowed his own achievement as a poet and as a critic and as a great enabler of visual arts in Ireland.
What was that connection with Beckett?
Well, he taught in Paris. McGreevy went to Trinity, and after his time teaching in Trinity, he moved to Paris to teach. After a period of time teaching in Paris, becoming pally with Joyce and other Irish writers, Beckett joined him. And they roomed for a period of time. And it was out of that relationship that Beckett was introduced to Joyce. But, I mean, all of Beckett's letters, so many, not all of them, but so many of these letters that he wrote to McGreevy are literally full of a very deep relationship that they shared. And as you know, Beckett then went on to greatness and international recognition. But His own life would be scarred and by war. Second World War.
Second World War. He was very much involved in the Second
absolutely,
World War.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, we generally think of war poets as being male, but Winifred Letts, who was born in England but raised and educated in Dublin, published a groundbreaking collection in 1916. Her time as a nurse in World War One comes through in her poetry, as we'll hear now.
They put the screens around his bed, a crumpled heap I saw him lie. While counterpane and rough dark head, those screens, they showed that he would die. They put the screens about his bed. We might not play the gramophone. And so we played at cards instead, and left him dying there alone. The covers on the screens are red, the counterpanes are white and clean. He might have lived and loved and wed, but now he's done for at 19. An ounce or more of Turkish lead, he got his wounds at Suvla Bay. They've brought the Union Jack to spread upon him when he goes away. He'll want those three and screens no more. Another man will get his bed. We'll make the row we did before. But Jove, I'm sorry that he's dead.
So Winifred Letts' experience working as a nurse during the war obviously had a profound effect on her, Gerry.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I suppose it's difficult for us to remember, the volume, the sheer damage that many of these men experienced as a result of World War One. And most of the story is obviously, understandably, fixed or focused on their shattered lives. But what about the doctors, the nurses, those who were involved in rehabilitation? All of that was also part. And Winifred Letts published in 1916 a famous volume of poems called Halloween and Poems of the War. And that was reissued then for an American audience under the title The Spars of Oxford. And in this volume, she really addresses some ahead of the time, really, poems about deserters, you know, something we're only now coming to terms with. She was a prominent novelist and playwright and poet, and it's nice to see in Lucy Collins's anthology of Irish women poetry, Letts coming back into publication again. But these poems of hers, as we've just heard, they're morally sensitive to the individual lives of soldiers.
She refuses, for example, to condemn the deserter of one of her poems.
Yeah.
That she's not morally entitled to do so. Patrick McGill, after whom the famous McGill Summer School in Donegal is named, is another who fought in the Great War. He wrote this poem after being wounded at the Battle of Loos on the 28th of October 1915.
The night is still and the air is keen, tense with menace the time crawls by. In front is the town and its homes are seen, blurred in outline against the sky. The dead leaves float in the sighing air, the darkness moves like a curtain drawn, a veil which the morning sun will tear from the face of death. We charge at dawn.
Now, McGill was already known as the Navy poet at the time that he enlisted and wrote three novels which related to World War One. And this is somebody who had left school at the age of 12.
He's an extraordinary figure. We really are only coming into face this history, our own history. And clearly, McGill is central to all of that. His memoir of, or his fictionalised memoir of the war, The Great Push, and the other two that you've mentioned, Miles, I mean, these should be in our classrooms. Mm. This is part of this extraordinary story of a young Donegal man who had been navvying. He worked in Scotland and moved to London, was part of, as you said, part of the war effort, as it was then known, and continued to publish, moving to America later on in his life with his wife. McGill, I, you know, in some fashion or other, McGill seems to have drifted off the landscape notwithstanding the importance of the summer school in his name. But as a writer, I mean, you can connect him with people like Liam O'Flaherty, that kind of a rough realism, the sense in engaging with history at its cutting edge, at its most brutal. It's all there in the prose. And also, I mean, the poems are like snapshots of a soldier's life. He himself was wounded, as you mentioned. I mean, in a way, he's a hero of our history. And maybe we haven't honoured these people sufficiently.
We'll come back to that, and because you're staying with us, we'll be talking about poetry here in spring 1914 in a moment. But before that, let's have a listen to this.
High up on the gallows tree swung the noble-hearted three, by the vengeful tyrants stricken in their bloom. But they met him face to face with the courage of their race, and they went with soul undaunted to their doom. God save Ireland, said the heroes. God save Ireland, said they all. Whether on the scaffold high or the battlefield we die, oh, what matter when for Ireland here we fall?
Rousing stuff there, sung by the Wolf Tones. God Save Ireland was written by T.D. Sullivan, Irish nationalist, politician and poet who died 100 years ago this March. It was written, of course, about Alan Larkin and O'Brien, the Manchester martyrs who were executed excuse me, in 1868. I'm also joined